This is Dialogue Conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Brussel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for 3 years shared with our listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and the abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary relates the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon, Dialogue Conspiracy. It's Monday afternoon in Carmel, May 27th. And we welcome to Dialogue Conspiracy, Boston University. They're going to be playing the tapes every week. Syracuse has been playing them the entire winter, back in New York, the whole school semester, and other stations around the country. And I hope that we can increase the listening audience so that it goes to many, many schools around the country. This is what I call a strictly May show. It's not like the other news broadcasts you get, and you'll get used to the format. I'll throw out a lot of leads or informations or opinions on political assassinations and conspiracies, and give references of documentation, or if I don't, you can write to KLRB if you want information about a particular thing that I mention. The format is to take the news of the week and show how it pertains to past political assassinations and conspiracies. And that's what we've been doing for the past 3 years here. I try not to duplicate the shows except where they pertain to something new in the news, to bring news up each week. And so you'll have to pick up today and start from there and catch the threads. We have been going, this is 3 years since the Pentagon Papers broke last year. This story, we've been on the air an hour a week or 45 minutes for 3 years. I want to talk about the SLA, of course. I want to fit it into the context of a national conspiracy. We'll talk about Donald DeFries. We've been talking out here on the West Coast since January about the SLA. And I wrote an article in March called "The SLA is the CIA," and another one on Donald DeFries being the first Black Lee Harvey Oswald that came out just a few weeks before he was murdered. And in that article, I also said that this script reads to kill Patricia Hearst as well, because they have to tie up the loose threads of what exactly the SLA is. And we'll talk about that some more. I think I'll open up in memory of Donald DeFries. I think we should open up a Carmel chapter of the SLA called Students Longing for Answers. Now that we have the Boston University and maybe others, I gave a course last year, just the next week is the last session, at Monterey Peninsula College called Conspiracies and Assassinations. It was the first accredited course in the country on political assassinations, and we had a really good session. 95 people took it for credit, all ages from college age to senior citizens. And the last week there were about 250 in the lecture forum, and we all met and discussed the killing of Donald DeFries and the other people in the house with him in Los Angeles. I received an assignment paper of one of the students that came to the house. They turned in workbooks with their notes and a final paper, which I thought was interesting, and I read it, and it was one of 10 questions they had a choice of answering, and thought maybe I should share it with you on the radio because it gives a little insight to what we were trying to do in the class and what I hope I accomplished. I won't give the name of the student. She had a choice of 10 questions, and number 4 on those was, H. Marcuse argues that exercises in free speech delude us into thinking we are free men, when in fact we are not. Has this class exercise in free speech made you feel any more free? And this is what the student wrote. I think that although this class has, as an exercise in free speech, made us more free in the sense that a class like this is finally being taught, it also makes us less free because it makes us realize how powerful the ruling government really is. This class has been allowed to discuss things that until now have never been taught in school, that weren't freely encouraged by the school. No one knew what class to sign up for, where it would be held, so that the school wasn't really too eager for the class, it seemed. And when the class started, it seemed that finally we had a chance to really learn something about the actions of our government. And we discovered that America isn't really the land of the free, How can you really feel free when you know what terrible things the CIA, the FBI, and the president himself have been up to? How can you feel free in a country where you know the rich people of this country have hired assassins to kill a president because he believes that blacks and whites are equal, or the war in Vietnam is wrong, or for other reasons? For me, it was a little too hard to believe, and thus a lot of what I've learned in this class made me feel less free. I find it hard to feel free when I know my government is openly ignoring evidence that could prove Lee Oswald is innocent, that ignores pictures people have showing no one in the window where Oswald supposedly shot JFK from. Why would a free country lock up pertinent evidence for 75 years when the people want the truth now? The more I learn in this class, the less free I feel. Although all the things I've learned support my conviction that this is no longer the great country it used to be, I also feel that through classes like this, we can gain the knowledge needed so that maybe someday we can wipe out the corruption that is presently allowed. Without the information that people have worked to discover, we'd still be in our own bubble believing the lies we've been told were truth. We need a class like this to pop our bubble of oblivion and make us aware that the government is up to no good. It makes me feel a little freer to know that people can get the facts if they look for them, and that we're still allowed to be told them in school. It makes me feel freer that there's a lot of researchers uncovering the lies and telling people about them. And maybe someday, through the beam of light these people have uncovered, will find our way out to true freedom. And so we welcome Boston to help put a light in a dark tunnel. Now, even though there were 95 students signed up for the class, and we had 120 or 140 every week, every single week for 16 weeks, there is no member of the faculty that will sign their name to that course for next September out here at Monterey Peninsula College. If you're interested in taking the course, you can write to KLRB. If we have a few names, 50 or more, I understand they may consider it, but there isn't one teacher in the history, humanities, or English department that will sign their name, because I don't have a teaching credential. And even though I've done 10 years, the equivalent of a law degree or a medical degree or teaching credentials, just 10 years study into political assassinations, there's no teacher that'll just sign their name, even though I would be teaching the 16 weeks. The class, I believe, was too much of a success for the establishment. It was a miracle it went through. And if the people in our local area want to know more, we'll get the information around. Otherwise, we'll get it through the tape and cassettes. Charles Bates of the FBI in San Francisco said, in regards to the SLA messages today, "You only need to have a tape recorder to set up a revolutionary movement today." He knows they've been had by the whole SLA thing, and that they were part of a massive conspiracy that they've been concealing that's going to get out of their hands rapidly now. So they're denying the whole revolutionary movement in terms of those tape cassettes that went on up there. But the same could be true. There can be a revolution of mind and information and getting to people the facts. Out in Salinas, in our local community, the students invited me to what they call a rap day. The purpose is to hear speakers which they said they can't ordinarily learn from in their own schools. See, this is the problem. We'll go into evidence of conspiracy, massive evidence, not hearsay, ballistic autopsy, court cases attempting to open up, but the schools will not teach anything like this. And when the students invited me from North Salinas High to be there May 10th for their rap day session to speak to each of their classes, I accepted, and I got a curt telephone about May 1st saying rap day is canceled. And I got a letter from North Salinas High School this week saying the high school officers expressed their apologies, that the students have a right to choose their own speakers for their own benefit, and the administration wouldn't allow them to have, I guess this was me, to speak at the rap day, so they canceled the whole event. The letter said the commission felt the administration would be molding rap day into what they wanted and not what the students wanted, and we couldn't continue the program if a speaker was prohibited from speaking merely because he was controversial. It would deviate from the principle of rap day to give students the opportunity to discuss topics not normally discussed in the classroom. The officers of the high school there are contemplating taking legal action against the school administration's decision. We express our apologies to you, and we hope that the student rights can be assured in the future. And I got a president a letter from the student body secretary apologizing, and they canceled the whole day because the faculty was stopping their ears from learning some truth about our system that would lead them out of this tunnel, like the letter that I read to you of the student who said those the things are not taught in school. Now, at the same time that the schools don't want the children to learn about children, adults either, I take it back, to learn the fact of conspiracies, you may have read in the paper this week, James Ray's attorney, Robert Livingston, is talking about the four prominent Americans who hired two gunmen to kill Martin Luther King. He quoted an intermediary saying that one of the trigger men is ready to talk and that it involves four wealthy men who were a conduit, of course, for higher-ups. Because without the help of the Justice Department and the FBI not giving out James Ray's fingerprints or identification and not finding him within hours of the killing of Martin Luther King, he was the patsy and became the decoy. By not solving these problems that could have been done very easily right from the start, the conspiracy has to go higher than the four men who purchased these two gunmen to do the political assassination of Martin Luther King. But one of the gunmen is ready to talk, and the truth will come out about all these cases, whether or not the Justice Department wants it or the Attorney General wants it. People will talk, and the investigations will be forced to be opened at the top level, like in the Watergate case, because people will begin, like James McCord began to talk, and then it opened up, not for any other reason. So in a week where you see, there's an article in the Houston Post that I had, I think, on the radio last week, the Supreme Court turned down the hearing of ballistic evidence to open up the John Kennedy assassination. The argument being the FBI said that they do not release investigatory files compiled for law enforcement purposes under the Freedom of Information Act. Well, the FBI has these for law enforcement purposes, but the law enforcement, unless I'm wrong, is to protect all of us. I thought law enforcement was to protect the citizens. If the killers are at large and able to do one continuous series of political assassinations after the other, I don't see where we're protected by them. And in the same week, down in Los Angeles this last week, there was the case opening up of the Board of Supervisors of the controversial two-gun theory of killing Robert Kennedy, and the fact Dr. Thomas Noguchi has stated in the original autopsy and again before the Board of Supervisors that the death gun could not be more than 1 to 3 inches from the senator's head when it was fired, and Sirhan wasn't in that position. The ballistics don't back it up. You have the John Kennedy assassination, FBI holding information on that, the Robert Kennedy ripe open for investigation, the Martin Luther King, one of the gunmen ready to talk. You compound all of these things and information coming in now about Donald DeFries and the SLA, which is a continuation of unsolved other criminal conspiracies, and you have to see the relationship, or I hope to show people who listen through the weeks, as I have in the last month since January, the relationship of the Patricia Hearst kidnapping to the past political assassinations, because it takes the same operatives, the same methods of operation that they used in the past political assassinations. Now, one of the clues is to this operation. There are two offices in Washington. Well, there's three. I call it the triangle there. The Office of Management Budget, William Sullivan of Division 5 of the FBI, and the White House, and formerly with John Ehrlichman at the White House. There's a triangle there that is keeping these things going, and they cannot be exposed until the people in office are exposed. But the problem with the Patricia Hearst kidnapping goes directly to the Division 5 in the White House, the National Security Council, and the Office of Management Budget. And I have to explain a little bit about those two offices in terms of articles that were in the paper this week, because people who have listened to other shows understand that I've hit at those hard in both my articles in The Realist and on the air many, many times. William Sullivan, formerly of the FBI, you heard his name at the time of the Watergate hearings from Division 5 of the FBI, was forced out of that office in October 71 by J. Edgar Hoover. He moved then to the White House. He is currently recuperating from a heart attack in a hospital in New Hampshire. I got this article from the Boston Globe dated May the 19th, 1974. It says, FBI ex-official charges John Dean lied. And it's about William Sullivan, whose name is in the news a lot lately. I wonder if his heart attack is like Dita Baird's, where he's in a hospital, sent away because the heat, I'm sure, has to be on him. His name came up too many times in the White House tapes. But what Mr. Sullivan is referring to that Dean talked about with the president was a March 13th White House tape where they were discussing previous administrations that used the FBI for political purposes. John Dean said, quote, I think probably what Bill Sullivan desires in life is to set up a domestic national security intelligence system, a White House program. He says we are deficient. He says we've never been efficient because Hoover lost his guts several years ago. And Dean then suggested that the president appoint Sullivan to study the possibility of a domestic system which could be operated within the CIA. Now, this is March 13th tapes. You know that the CIA is not supposed to be operating domestically, but it is. It's in the police departments of all the major cities and in the prison systems currently. Operatives are placed inside the prison systems. And Dean says Sullivan wants to be the head of this domestic security agent. See, a White House program. And he said Hoover lost his gut several years ago. And the president, he says, the president appointed Sullivan then to study the possibility of this domestic system within the CIA, a domestic intelligence, and the president said, we will do it. Then Dean said, I think the quid pro quo with Sullivan is that he wants someday to be back in the bureau very badly. And the president said, that's easy. What Sullivan is claiming now is that he doesn't want the job back in the bureau. But why would he? He's the operator between defense intelligence agencies. And I named it in my article, The Realist, the second one I did last year in July 73. I spoke about Division 5 of the FBI, of William Sullivan working with Robert Mardian, Internal Security, taking tapes from the desk of J. Edgar Hoover that would cause political damage to Nixon and Agnew. And being the head, he's alleged to be the head of a five-prong operation that was responsible for all of the for the John Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy. Now, these allegations seem to be backed up by evidence coming in from all fronts and demands a congressional investigation. And the five friends I mentioned many times are the Solidaris, the CIA emigres, the American Council of Christian Churches, the Miami Syndicate, the Cuban Exile Group, and the Security Division of NASA, headed by Werner von Braun. It was Mr. Sullivan, William Sullivan, mentioned in Zodiac News Service March 21st, who was interviewed about that co-intel pro organization, the domestic spy group. They asked him if he approved of it. He said he confirmed his involvement in the co-intel pro group. I approved of it 1,001%. Now, if you don't understand the domestic internal spy system, realize that the Patricia Hearst affair was planned at least 2 years ago, maybe in 1970, and this is 74. It dates back to this well-conceived plan, complicated plan, that I've been spending 6 months trying to break down. And William Sullivan not only approved of it 1,001%, this co-intel program of domestic spying using the intelligence agencies, but he did actions that J. Edgar Hoover didn't approve of and didn't tell him and never learned of the incidents. Another conversation in that March 13th talk, William Sullivan referred, John Dean was talking, and he referred to the allegiance of William Sullivan of Division 5, formerly the FBI, and Dean said, If we have one liability in Sullivan here, it is his knowledge of the former blank, blank, blank that occurred here. And I think we could fill in the blanks with the proper congressional investigation if they ever had the nerve to go into it. Another background besides the internal use of CIA field people in the police departments, particularly in the Donald DeFries, Patty Hearst, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, the state of California, law enforcement and police agencies. Another prong that's important to understand the motives for the Hearst kidnapping, for the setting up of Donald DeFries, has to do with the Office of Management Budget. I have an article here from the Houston Post, dated May the 19th. And it says, this is the headline, powerful Nixon counsel tied to vast secret political plan. And for those of you who listen to my radio shows about the Office of Management Budget or have read the article I did in The Realist, again, I talked about the martial law without the riots. And I referred to the domestic council, the Office of Management Budget, which takes decision-making out of the hands of Congress and will be a conduit for economic chaos in this country and deprivation of minorities, which in turn causes riots. And one purpose of the Hearst script was to have proper control of the minorities and manipulate them at the time that legitimate terrorist or guerrilla groups would be formed out of desperation. The Office of Management Budget is causing economic chaos in this country. It is affecting the minorities and the poor. They're anticipating riots and protests, violence and gang wars, and they're utilizing the SLA Army, those handful of operatives, to cover the crisis that they are causing by impounding the funds. Now, the Houston Post, in going into the use of the domestic council, refers to the fact that Richard Nixon impounded several hundred million dollars in federal funds. You know, they're going into the impeachment question of his impounding money that Congress allocated last year. But Nixon's domestic counsel impounded several hundred million dollars of federal funds that were supposed to go to Spanish-speaking, blacks, labor, aged, youth, Catholic, Jews, and others. Others, I imagine, are American Indians. I don't know who's left here. But hundreds of millions of dollars in the, in the responsiveness program. It's called the Responsiveness Program, was held up and has been held up and still is from these particular minority people that need this money. As a matter of fact, $61 million that was passed and allocated for Spanish-speaking people is being held up, and the empowerment of these funds and then using them to twist the minorities to vote for the Nixon administration is so great that the Senate Select Committee is only investigating two areas, the black and the Spanish-speaking, and they're not going into labor, aged, youth, Catholic, Jews, how they affect these people. But hundreds of millions of dollars were put in that were allocated through federal money, and they speak about a quarter of a billion, have been tied up. And this is through Nixon's domestic counsel, and then to John Ehrlichman and Kenneth Cole, the number two man under Ehrlichman. Ehrlichman's been removed, and Cole is the director of the domestic counsel. But there's a triangle here of the White House managing, supervising all of this, with the intelligence agencies at one prong, moving the operatives, programming men like Donald DeFries, bringing in through LEAA the SWAT tax squad to burn the evidence behind them to make the cover story hold. And the triangle from the White House to the intelligence agencies to the Office of Management Budget, which is creating the chaos on our streets, the deprivation of the minorities and reducing their job opportunities and legal aid for the poor. There's a whole list of manipulative devices the Office of Management Budget is using to frustrate the poor, the aged, youth, labor, and so forth, and minorities, to create a condition that makes them more aggressive on the streets, and then you slap back with more law and order, and all the contingencies are there to handle these people as they get deprived of jobs and housing and food. The SLA, we'll go on now to the SLA because I've spent a whole week since the slaughter in Los Angeles analyzing evidence of what was taking place there. Briefly, I'll run down a few of my conclusions, and then in the next weeks that follow, we'll take maybe one or two of them at a time and tell you what backs up my conclusions or the evidence. But I realize now that Patricia Hearst, five men and women, Willie Wolfe and the other women, and Donald DeFries, were positively set up in that house in Los Angeles. They were lured down there, and there isn't one reasonable explanation how the police found them, except the fact that a black man bought a van in San Francisco under the name of Ricky Delgado and paid $1,800 cash and gave an address to a fictitious location on Fillmore Street in San Francisco. And this van, this red and white van, was used the day before, on Thursday, the day before the killing, and was left on a street with the address of the house on 84th Street. Now, that van was left there with the address in it for a purpose. It was a setup. The Harrises didn't have to leave that van. They were lured down to L.A. the week of the 6th to the 10th. The SLA were told that they were in safe places, and the six that were murdered were cremated there in a place that we'll go into briefly, their fantasy that they're safe and the reality that they were going to die. Patricia Hearst was set up from Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. at that phony shootout, and I will go at length about that, at the sporting goods store. And she was taken by the Harrises and I believe the narcotic agents from Indiana. There's evidence that they are narcotic agents from Indiana. They took her on a ride from 4 p.m. Thursday afternoon until Sunday evening, until every charge, 19 charges, were laid on her that she was a dangerous criminal. And if you break down the charges, I have them here, 5 counts of assault to intent to commit murder, 4 counts of assault with deadly weapon, assault with a deadly weapon against Patricia alone and not against the Harrises, 3 counts of unlawfully taking a vehicle, 1 count of simple kidnapping, 1 count of kidnapping for the purpose of robbery. You break them all down, and they were purposely staged at every point of the game through one Tom Matthews, who conveniently had a car for sale after they tripped out 3 other cars. And they carefully identified Patricia Hearst, introduced her. She had on a wig. You know who this is. This is Tanya. Set up all the evidence so that Matthews was rushed to San Francisco on Monday for a quick grand jury hearing, and they could charge her with 19 charges, thereby making her a dangerous criminal, thereby giving the excuse to kill her, the law enforcement, anytime they want. They have not tested the validity of Matthews. There's no way of, with fingerprints, saying that was Patricia Hearst. He's never seen Patricia Hearst in his life. They carefully kept her for 12 hours, going to a drive-in movie, out to dinner, driving all around the town. If the Harrises had abandoned a van with their address in it, they would have taken the first car they kidnapped, the Pontiac, and gone right back to 84th Street and gotten their belongings, their ID, their wigs, and food that they put in the house. And they didn't have to take a ride all around town and end up in the Hollywood Hills at 6 in the morning, leaving Matthews off with his car, and they're on foot. That three motley crowd, Patricia Hearst in a black Afro wig, and William Harris and Emily Harris, left off around Griffith Park, and the man whose car they have, he drives off in the car, and they're supposed to hitch, and we don't know where they are, what transportation picked them up. We're told the heart of the SLA is gone with 6 dead. There's only 3 more, but somebody has to come up with who's driving them around now. If they didn't have a person and give him his car back and they're on foot, who's taking care of them now? Not SLA, but some law enforcement people disguised as comrades who are tripping them out on their next scene. Otherwise, the law enforcement would be looking for other members of the SLA. They've reduced it down to just these members that are left, so obviously it has to be law enforcement disguised who are carrying them around until they can achieve another murder of these 3 and wipe them out. There was this big rush to get the 19 charges on her, and we'll go on to those during the next weeks. I come to the conclusion now, I may change my mind later, I very seldom have, as the evidence comes in, that three of the people in the house were murdered. They were shot at close range. The first autopsy of Thomas Noguchi was that the ballistics came at a long distance away. Then he said Donald DeFries shot himself in the head. You can't all be shot from a long distance and shoot your own self in the head. So he had 7 days to change that opinion in Los Angeles. Three of the people in the house that they would be most anxious to kill first to silence would be Nancy Ling Perry and Camilla Hall and Donald DeFries. Nancy Ling died by a shot right through her spinal column and lungs, died immediately. Camilla Hall died with a shot in the center of her forehead. Donald DeFries had a bullet wound directly to the head. The other four, when the house exploded in fire, were burned alive or had passed out from asphyxiation. Now, that's are pretty good shots from a long distance, shooting through a plaster stucco house at the distance that the 500 law enforcement, how many were shooting, all these volleys going back and forth, to hit one in the spine from the back, one in the center of the forehead, and one in the temple. Now, I think if investigators get onto it and get the police reports that day, I predict that a man standing on 54th Street in Compton in the alley, an off-duty sheriff, had a clear view through the window of the house that was open during the day to take those three before the house caught fire to make sure that they didn't run out alive. Now, in every assassination, there's been a backup. In the John Kennedy assassination, in the Robert Kennedy assassination, two gunmen in down Martin Luther King. And I predict that Willie Wolfe and Ms. Atwood and Ms. Moon died from asphyxiation, because after Ms. Johnson left the house and ran out, the other woman that was there, the others could have run out with her. But if they got a good clear shot, and there was an off-duty sheriff, and the police record will back this up, on 54th Street in plain clothes, and Donald DeFries was aware of a clear window view straight out that alley. And if he could see one way, they could see another. And I think it will account for making sure that Nancy Ling Perry and Ms. Hall and Donald DeFries would not go out of that house alive. There were three vans purchased in San Francisco that brought them down here. Those purchases have to be from agents of the Los Angeles Police Department. It doesn't take much logic to figure that out, because there's no search warrant for them. Now, the LAPD has a special desk. They're not great lovers. They use black agents like Louis Tackwood, who surfaced, or Donald DeFries. They have a black department under Sergeant Farwell, and they have black men in the prison system, informers, up and down this, in every prison in California. But they use them. They don't love them. They use them. And when they no longer need them, they kill them, like Donald DeFries. And one of these vans was purchased by a black man. I told you the alias of Ricky Delgado. Now, isn't it strange that there's not an all-out alert description for this man, or the green car that he left in San Francisco, that a man is supplying a car for the SLA to drive them from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and inside that car is going to be the address where they stayed in Los Angeles. Now, inside, when the car got a parking ticket, if you read Newsweek this week, there was a parking ticket that had the address of the house on 84th Street. Now, in order for the Department of Motor Vehicles to have that address, that house had to be known weeks or several months in advance. I called the police department to check how you would get the address. If there's a license on a car, on a van, and you give a ticket and the car is locked, they radio up to Sacramento and get the address of that particular residence. And the address for the red and white van that the SLA used was inside the van that was abandoned. And that's why I say that shootout in front of Mills Sporting Goods shop for 45-cent pair of socks was a staged shootout so Patricia Hearst would see the Harrises having this confrontation, shoot her weapon into the air 30 feet high. It didn't hurt anybody. The SLA has given no indication, incidentally, of being violent in any situation they were in. They could have shot people many times, even at the bank, escaped one. Two men were hit, one lightly. We don't know the actual medical report of the other two. Other than that, they're not known for any violence. And at the Sporting Goods store, Patricia was letting out 30 rounds of her gun at the building 30 feet high. But it made her record now for using an automatic weapon. And by staging that, they could place this charge on her. And I believe these were staged. There were two black agents supposedly with Patricia Hearst. They got her on a charge. One of the ridiculous charges was that she was in Hollywood with two black men and she wanted a room, and she accosted a woman who said, you know who we are, we're the SLA, and we want a room, two black men and Patricia Hearst. And the woman gave a description entirely different than Patricia Hearst. And one black man was on the steps nearby, and another one came up to this woman with a knife and cut her dress. That's Mrs. Alcala in Hollywood on Sunday night. And the story, the charge for Patricia Hearst for assault with a deadly weapon, which would give her life imprisonment, according to District Attorney Bush down in Los Angeles, was this scene where she didn't even cut the dress of the woman, but the LAPD doesn't have any alert or description of the men. They're using a second Patty Hearst that doesn't fit the description at all to get a pile of charges against her. They used a second Donald DeFries in Buffalo, and who knows where else that was an important part of this conspiracy that I'm writing about. And they have a second Patty Hearst who is running up these arrest records that would be an excuse to kill her. The use of doubles has been used in the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, an agent by the name of Wayne, whose name is associated with the Minutemen in California, with Martin Luther King, with all the political conspiracies. There were James Ray, there were doubles. And there are doubles going around now with the SLA, with DeFries and Patty Hearst bringing these charges. It can't be verified, any of these 19 charges, that Mr. Matthews, Tom Matthews, knew that was Patricia Hearst at all. Now, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, the coroner in Los Angeles, has said, we've never seen anything like this in our lives. He's called in a forensic pathologist and psychologist to do a psychological autopsy on the SLA. And in the next weeks, in the article I'm writing at the present time, we'll talk about the CIA psychological autopsies. They did one on Oswald that doesn't fit any evidence of what Oswald was at all. The same agency writes a profile of Sirhan, of Arthur Brammer, of James Ray, of Jack Ruby, and none of them fit the people. The evidence shows conspiracies, therefore the psychiatrist, used like in Nazi Germany, has to come in and bring in these fictitious stories. Now, the SLA only makes sense in the evidence coming in that it was a military operation, the collusion of the Department of Corrections, the police department, the attorney general's office. And the way I see this, I'm going to do my own psychological autopsy of the SLA, because everything about it from the beginning to its almost end was irrational, unless you think of it as a right-wing paramilitary group that were into a kamikaze mission. They were not left radicals at all. There were no radicals in the Bay Area that accepted them. Each one of them they approached thought they were police agents. The violence, the killing of Dr. Marcus Foster made no sense according to what Foster was doing in the Oakland area. The kidnapping of Patricia was not a revolutionary act. They would have taken her father, the corporate man. Feeding $70 bag of food to the poor persons and specifying Safeway was not revolutionary. Everywhere they went, they identified themselves. This is Tanya at the bank. On the walls of the house, they left Tanya. They go, Mr. Matthews in the car when there's fugitives. Do you know who this is? This is Tanya. Always identify themselves. Shock value of calling their father a liar, leaving apartments filled with cockroaches crawling downstairs. They couldn't possibly, if their motive was to help political prisoners, not one of them did anything for one prisoner in the state of California that can be pointed to as any value. The last person with them, one of the people, Mr. Harris, by mistake, left a wallet, which the FBI always loses these clues, the police department, a neighbor, somebody picked up at the house that burned down. It had his Army military ID card. Also in their possessions at one of the houses was a military manual from Pennsylvania. These people were recruiting people at the SLA the day that they were supposed to be dying. They were putting on belts and recruiting people for their army. They held nobody as hostages, and they couldn't explain their motives. Ramiro, Joseph Ramiro, who came home from two tours of Vietnam, was trying to get the Vietnam veterans to think of a program of segregating the races in this country, the blacks, whites, and Chicanos, like in South Africa. There was no interest in giving the extra $4 million to the poor that they talked about. There was a intention to place Ramiro and Little into San Quentin that I've done a lot of investigation or work on, that they wanted them inside of there. So from inside the prison out, they can continue talking about revolutionary guerrilla movements through the media to get Mr. Saxby in Washington and Senator John Harmer and people in Sacramento nervous about world terrorists. They changed houses for no reason. They left clothes and food. They were sending some people out to buy food on 54th Street when there was food over at 84th Street. None of this makes sense. None of it makes sense unless you go into the background of the people like Hitler's youth, young people that left Hitler's organization. A German by the name of Rolf Steiner belonged to the youth cub. He later joined they were called the Wolf Cubs. There's an article about him in the New York Times, August 17, 1971, who worked for the CIA, the Hitler Youth, who were tremendously racist, very religious. They were concerned with Christianity and racism, and the SLA group, Donald DeFries, was into a very religious God trip and could be used by these people because of his extreme devout Christianity. He could be brainwashed by the military, which he was at Vacaville. Now, these people died, those six, without knowing what the SLA was, because they're not supposed to know what they were. You're not supposed to know, and that's why the other three would have to die, because you're not supposed to know what they were or how they were programmed. And the hardcore members, the media tells you it were 11 or 12 persons. But they're not telling you about the printing press, the money they had before a bank robbery. They're not going into many pieces of evidence on the criminal conspiracy involved. It involved a lot of people, overeducated, conservative, military, such as Russell Little and Joseph Ramiro. Angela Atwood, Gary Atwood, Emily Harris, and William Harris were all from Indiana and part of Narcotic Informers Group. The answer to the SLA comes not only from the programming in the prison of Donald DeFries. The answer comes in the passport of Willie Wolf that was found at the house that nobody discussed before, in the police knowing about the kidnapping 3 weeks before that did nothing about it, of not looking for Theo Wheeler, who had to be the contact for CINQ that he trusted, who he once tried to kill because maybe he didn't trust at the time. The answer will be in the two black men that can go to a house and get an arrest record on Patricia and not come out with any charge themselves. They cut the dress and Patricia gets the charge for assault. They don't. The answer to the SLA will come in the blue and white van plus one other van. $5,300 was paid for three vans. And I wonder if that money can be traced to the bank robbery or if that's extra CIA funding. I don't believe that $5,300 came from the bank robbery. I think it came from intelligence, Operation Wash, many times, and could easily be traced. The LAPD, I understand, has the three vans that they were transported in. They're strangely silent about the blue and white. The truth will come in and who bought those vans, where they are now, and why the police aren't looking for them, why they limit the SLA now all over the state to Patricia and the two Harrises when they have arrest charge for Patricia with two black men in Hollywood and black men buying cars for them and vans. It only has to do with the LAPD that lured them down there and helping to purchase those vans. Those three vans are one of the clues to what's happening. They found guns, registered weapons, in the house that burned down. One to Angela Atwood. Now, if that was registered to her, and each one of those had a gun registered in their name, the police had 3 months to check that out. At the time of the Foster shooting up in Oakland, Angela Atwood's husband's name, Bill Atwood's helmet, his postal helmet, he worked for the post office department, was in that house. She worked for University of California for a polling service. All they had to do was to find out that the Atwoods had a gun registered to them. The people in that house, that was 3 weeks before the Patricia Hearst kidnapping. Now people are saying they were at a rifle range. They could have identified all of this before the kidnapping. And the car location where it was bought was a block from the FBI. In San Francisco, their houses were all within a block of the police department in Oakland, the safe house where Dr. Marcus Foster was killed. I have a list of about 30 reasons that it was a military operation. The CIA and the SLA are all linked. It is a military operation. But unless we go into that Division 5 and the CIA in domestic affairs that Richard Nixon approved of with John Dean on the March tape, unless we go into the domestic Office of Management Budget with Roy Ash Dead, whose conduit overthrew Greece, we cannot get the military answers to the Hearst kidnapping. That was planned in advance several years ago, and it's part of that same operation that is going on across the country now. So we have to open up the OMB and the White House intelligence for the answers, full answers, to the Hearst kidnapping. Well, that's all. Our time is up, and I'll be with you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.
This has been...